part of the invitation to speak here, although it was quite a late invitation.
I couldn't stay as long as I might have liked, but I bet I'm the one who got the
latest invitation.
If you had the right measure, you would have predicted it.
Yes. So I'm going to talk about some recent work with Raphael Musso, Stefan Leichnauer, and Vladimir Lodenhaus, you know, about students at Berkeley. But there's a wide range of people here, so I'm going to try to give a talk that's of interest and comprehensible to the people here. So I'm not going to focus narrowly on what we did. But please stop me if I'm being unclear. I will describe our work, but I won't focus narrowly on that. So here's the basic outline of the talk. First, I'm going to start with an introduction. And basically, I want to tell you two things. The first one is that in order to get predictions from string theory for observable quantities, like, say, the mass of the Higgs particle, we need to understand the dynamics of eternal inflation. The dynamics of eternal inflation will tell us that the predictions are actually insensitive to the initial conditions, in the sense that I will make more precise. But understanding the dynamics of eternal inflation is difficult. There's an ambiguity called the measure problem, which is that there's an infinite space-time volume, and so there's an ambiguity in understanding the late-time behavior of eternal inflation. Okay, the behavior is insensitive to the initial conditions, but it's cutoff dependent. And I will, of course, describe this in more detail. Then I'll go on to the second part to talk about our proposed cutoff. So our proposal is called, I can't say that I chose this name, but it has been chosen now, the paper has been published. Our proposal is called the new light cone time. And I'll tell you why. That's a simple, elegant proposal. And I'll tell you some of the consequences of this proposal. And then, in the next part, I want to talk about the relationship to other proposals, to other cutoffs. And there's some good news here. The cutoffs, which are not yet ruled out by observation, have certain universal features, which are common to all of them. So, I want to describe this exciting development in this field, which is that there are some universal features which everyone is agreeing upon. Okay? Then, let me just put it over here. Then, I'll tell you the bad news about the problems, the things which are not still completely well-defined or are not satisfactory in this context, and a few interesting things that could be worked out in the future. Right.
So are you saying in the end it's independent of cutoff, or just that everybody's chosen a cutoff which happens to agree with everybody else? I mean,
that's right. There are certain features which are common to all of the cutoffs.
So there are some things that are just really, you could take any cutoff and it'd be okay.
Well, it's probably not true that you could take any cutoff. People have analyzed, you know, simple proposals.
Okay.
So you can see whether you're tempted to invent a different one, which will which will disagree with these universal predictions. Okay, all I'm saying is there's a few cutoffs that people have invented, and they agree on certain things. Okay, so throughout this talk, I'm going to work in the simplest possible context for clarity. And I'm going to start with a question which I think some of you have had an opportunity to vote on before, but perhaps you've revised your thinking since you had a chance to vote on it. So let's consider this simple toy model of the landscape. Okay, so here's a false vacuum which eternally inflates. And there's a large barrier in this direction. So here's some false vacuum. And there's a small barrier in this direction. Okay? So here's this false vacuum. On this side, on the other hand, you get to only have 70 e-foldings of inflation. And on this side, you get to have 100 e-foldings of inflation. Now, here's vacuum A, and here's vacuum B, each of which we might be living in. There's no other eternal inflation going on in this picture. The only eternal inflation is happening up here. Okay? Now, this one has a Higgs mass of 125 GeV, and this one has a Higgs mass of 141 GeV. In all other respects, these vacuum are identical. We could be living in each one. Now, I should tell you one more thing, which is these tunneling rates. So the decay rate from the false vacuum into this vacuum A, the subject was colonized by Russians, and so the decay rate from F to A is written like this. that decay rate is given by e to the minus 20. Sorry about the decay rate in Hubble units, so that's a dimensionless quantity. And on the other hand, the decay rate from F to B is e to the minus 5. Okay? So that's the situation. Those are the parameters of the theory. And before I go on to talk about what I think about this, let me give you an opportunity to vote. Here's some options. Which Higgs mass, where should we predict that we're living? A, vacuum A, vacuum B. I want to tell you one more thing, which is that the initial conditions tell you that there's a finite probability to eternally inflate. I'm not willing to tell you anything more about what the initial conditions are, except they're finite, and they give you a finite probability to eternally inflate. So option C is that it depends on initial conditions. And these are all the options I was going to give you, but I want to make sure that everyone here had an option they could vote for. So I'm going to add another option, which is that on some days, the LHC sees 125. All right. So, option A, can I get a show of hands?
Which option A is?
Option A is that we go to this side with more E foldings and a slower tunneling rate. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Five or so. Okay. Option B, that we go to this side. 1, 2, 3.
I'll
okay, so we have 5 here, we have 4 here. Option C.
Can I ask a question before I... No. The question is, does the final probability to eternally inflate? Where is the eternal inflation here happening?
Okay.
Is that the false vacuum?
This is where the eternal inflation is happening.
Okay, no.
Would you like to cast your vote now?
What do the initial conditions consist of in
the
system?
Well, I'm going to talk about things in a semi-classical way. So let's just say they say that there's some probability to start with one Hubble volume here, and some probability to start with one Hubble volume here, and some probability to start with one Hubble volume there.
You didn't tell us the probability is to tunnel into the ABS vacua.
Okay, let's say they're equal. These are equal in all respects except for the number of e-foldings in the Higgs maps. All right, so let's see. We have 5 and 4. All right, option C. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. And option D. All right. Does anyone else want to? All right. So
many people are abstaining here, but
what's maybe a wise course of action?
Tell us the answer at the end, I want.
I will. Well, in fact, I'll tell you the answer now, and later I'll tell you why that's the answer. So all of the cutoffs under consideration today will tell us that option B is the right answer. And this is kind of one of those more or less universal things that's coming out of these measures. But I'll tell you later why it's coming out of that. Okay.
This is independent of the counting factors of how many vacuums of each type. Well, we're just saying there are two.
This is
that's
the landscape.
That's the whole thing.
that's it.
The whole thing.
For the moment. Okay, so now...
is it related to the fact that 30 is 15 times 2, or no?
all right, so the first point that I want to make, though, is I want to make an argument that the answer is independent of initial conditions. But let me tell you more precisely what the correct statement is. Probably no. Let's suppose you start... You have the following three conditions. First of all, let's suppose you have finite initial conditions. Let's just say finite volume initial conditions. Okay, no divergence is present in the initial conditions, infinite numbers of bubbles or anything like that. Let's suppose, second of all, that the initial conditions tell you that you have a finite probability to eternally inflate. And third of all, let's say you pick some time coordinate, which I'm just going to say is reasonable. Say you choose some reasonable time coordinate. And now, let's suppose that you evolve this system for a long time, starting from these initial conditions. And say you take the limit as this time coordinate goes to infinity. And you calculate, let's say, the number of bubbles of this type compared to the number of bubbles of that type. Okay. Then this thing is going to approach a constant, which in this case is going to be the ratio of tunneling rates. Okay, this isn't yet necessarily the answer to this question. I'm just talking about the number of bubbles. Of each type. The limit of this ratio is going to approach a constant independent of the initial conditions.
So when you have collisions of bubbles, then what do you call it?
I mean, that's something different. But at the moment, I'm just counting nucleations of each one of these bubbles, which is a relatively well-defined. Okay, now, why does this happen? I mean, let me just draw some kind of picture. Suppose you start with some, it's hard to draw a probability distribution, so let's just suppose we start with some volume over here, which maybe is in vacuum A, and some other volume in vacuum B, and some other volume in the false vacuum. Okay, so then some stuff is going to happen here. But after a while, it's going to crunch, because I said that there was no eternal inflation happening there. After a while, this thing is going to crunch. On the other hand, this is going to eternally inflate. And so if I draw a conformal diagram, this false vacuum never gets completely eaten up, and it keeps producing bubbles of different types. And so then, if I draw some late-time slice through here, then I think it's quite plausible that the decay rates of F are going to control this ratio. And that we're not going to care how much volume was initially here or there. Okay? And I'll show later more carefully that that turns out to be true. But I think this is quite believable. And more generally, for any two types of events, they don't have to be bubble nucleations, and in a more general landscape, it's also going to be true that this limit of any two types of events is going to approach a constant. So more generally, the limit of the number of events of one type compared to the number of events of another type, in the limit that the time becomes very light, approaches some constant independent of initial conditions. Okay? So, now when I say independent of initial conditions, of course I have this caveat, a couple of caveats about the initial conditions. But within that space of initial conditions, the answer is independent of what those initial conditions are.
Well, certainly I can find a cutoff procedure for that red line, which gives a different answer. Crazy cutoff.
Well, any time variable you're going to define is going to be, at the moment I'm just talking about the independence of the initial conditions. You're not questioning that?
Or? No, I'm not questioning that.
Okay. So, rather than looking for, so I would say that in order to make predictions, rather than looking for a prescription for initial conditions, what we need to do is to understand the dynamics of eternal inflation. Okay? So, what we need to understand instead is basically the steady state behavior, the late time behavior of eternal inflation. Rather than looking for the initial conditions.
You haven't proven this. You assume that this is obvious that this limit goes to a constant.
Well, okay, I'll prove it in a particular context later, and then we can talk about how generally it's true. I believe that this is very...
If you say steady state, you're sure to mean that the ratio is a number. Otherwise,
that's
it's
right.
Not steady.
No, that's right, but I think he's saying I should prove that from some initial conditions it actually will approach a constant.
Once you say steady state, haven't you implicitly defined it to be constant?
Well, right, but then you might say the true dynamics don't really have a nice steady state and they just oscillate or something. But, yeah, let's come back to this. Okay, so I'll talk about how to define this limit and so on, but before I do that, I want to make an important point, which is that now suppose that we're not just in this toy landscape, but more generally, we want to compute the probability of seeing different things at the LHC. Okay? So in order to make a prediction for, say, two different Higgs masses, the natural way to do that in this context is to look at all of the data we have as priors. So we look at all of the places in this eternally inflating multiverse. We look at all of the places that agree with all of our data that we have. And then we just count. And we count the number of places, the number of LHCs that measure 141 GeV. And we count the number of LHCs that measure 125 GeV. So we count those numbers. Each of those numbers individually will become infinite, but their ratio will be finite. And then we say, here's our prediction. The relative probability of detecting these two things is given by the number of events of that type, this ratio, in the limit t goes to infinity.
Is there only one LHC in each of those?
No, there could be many. I mean, so now I don't want to talk about bubbles. I want to just say, we're counting the probability for any two types of events. Just count the number of events of that type without reference to bubbles or anything. And just count that number. That ratio is our prediction for what's going to happen.
Oh, that's not a probability. That's a number.
These are probabilities, and these are numbers.
But the volumes of the near homogeneous parts of these two universes are very different. And so there are a lot more civilizations in a bigger volume.
E to the 100 versus E to the 70.
Yeah.
Well, so that may come into this counting here. I think what you're saying is that you think the number of LHC is measuring 1 for 41 is going to be much larger because of the bigger expansion.
Bigger unit.
All right, so we'll come to whether that's true or not. But for the moment, I want to just say more generally that this is the natural way to make predictions in this theory. Now, in case, I know it's very unlikely, but in case there's any skeptics in the audience, so we question whether making a probabilistic prediction makes sense when we can't repeat this experiment and measure the full probability distribution. Okay, so does a probabilistic prediction for, say, the Higgs mass make sense? Or is this a morally bankrupt enterprise? And what I would say is, in principle,
oh, what was
it? Sorry?
Yeah.
In principle, it's no different from our predictions for, let's say, the L equals 5 CMD. I'm about to tell you that it is different in some way. In principle, it's no different. We only get one sky. We have a probabilistic prediction for the CMB at L equals 5. There's a certain cosmic variance that's finite, but it doesn't prevent us from analyzing that theory. It doesn't tell us, nobody goes around saying slow roll inflation is morally bankrupt because it only makes a probabilistic prediction for L equals 5. So at that level, it's no different. Now, there is an important way in which it is different. There are two important ways. One important difference is the amount of technical control. Slow roll inflation is a relatively controlled theory. And on the other hand, understanding eternal inflation, the string theory landscape, is not under good technical control. That's one issue. The second issue is just the number of predictions. Okay, with slow roll inflation, we have a simple theory which predicts a whole bunch of L's. And so we're willing to take the L equals 5 along with it. And we also don't have a large number of predictions from this sort of eternal inflation. We don't have a large number of predictions of the nature of what's the Higgs mass. So these are both technical obstacles which I think need to be surmounted in order for this probabilistic prediction to be on the same footing as this one. But there's no in-principle difference between making a probabilistic prediction for the Higgs mass or for the L equals 5 CMB. So that's my
For the predictions to be interesting, you do need some kind of correlation. Like here you have a correlation between the in your landscape between the Higgs mass and other things like that decay rate.
Well, I would, if this was the whole landscape, I would already be interested because even without correlations, because I can predict the Higgs mass.
No, but the only reason you can predict it is because you...
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes.
And the worry about the landscape being bankrupt is, I thought, was mostly that people imagine that everything's independently variable, so there's just no... like having a Higgs of 141 be correlated with the decay rate of E to minus 5 versus anything else.
Yeah, okay. So I think that's a quantitative question of how sharp the predictions
are. Right, that's a pessimistic.
And I agree that that's certainly... We're certainly going to be much happier if the predictions are nice and sharp. Okay, so now...
But inflation, it is naturally sharp because it predicts L equals 5. So you have so many observables, you can say the average of DCL is this number, and this probability 1. So if you get something also, you need something also in the landscape like that. Then you're predicting. So if the ratio is 1 alpha...
You have a finite number of L's, and there's a finite number of things we can predict in the landscape. So in principle, it's 1.
That's the threshold we say that the minus 5. 10 to the 5 is 0.
Yeah, 10 to the 5 sigma. Okay, all right. Now, what's the problem? So in this kind of context, I've argued that it's natural to count, to compute this ratio. Now, there's a basic problem, which is that this ratio, limit of this ratio, depends on our choice of time coordinate. Or it depends on our choice of cutoff. Depends on how we take this limit that t goes to infinity, which perhaps is not surprising, since this number is infinite and this number is infinite. So you can get different answers depending on on how you take that limit. And to illustrate a simple example, let's consider a different potential. Just simply that potential. Two positive energy vacua. Let's call one C and one D. And let's ask a question, which is not exactly this number, but which will clarify the fact that the attractor behavior is sensitive to the cutoff. Okay? Let's just ask, at late times, how much volume is in C and how much volume is in vacuum D? Okay? Now, does someone want to tell me which one is the right answer? No one is quite willing to jump into that trap. Okay. So, there's two extremely simple procedures you can use. One is to start with some initial conditions, it won't matter what, and then evolve with proper time. Okay? At late time, you have some regions of C and some regions of D. What you're going to find with proper time is that the volume, this vacuum inflates faster than this vacuum. Okay? If you foliate with proper time, that means that this vacuum is going to win. On the other hand, if you use an equally reasonable time coordinate, which is the scale factor time, scale factor time is just defined by evolving by one e-folding everywhere, rather than by the same amount of proper time. There, we're going to find exactly the opposite, that the volume in the lower vacuum is much larger, because that's the ground state, roughly. All right? I think these both have some intuitive value to them. And what I'm going to tell you later is that this answer is wrong. This time coordinate has been ruled out because it conflicts with observation, because of something called the Young's paradox. Okay. But this has illustrated the fact that the attractor behavior depends on the cutoff.
General relativity is the foliation invariant theory, so how can you say that the foliation is ruled out?
Well, it's true that general relativity, I mean, I would just say in general relativity without any additional structure, this ratio is not well defined. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, I want this ratio to be well defined because it seems like the natural way to make predictions. So, I'm going to put some additional structure on top of general relativity, which does make this ratio defined. Okay? That additional structure could be I want to take a late time cutoff using the proper time, or I want to use a different time coordinate. Then I have a prediction, and that prediction can disagree with observation.
The logic is you believe that there should be some measure, but you don't know what the right measure is.
Yeah.
You don't know what the principles are, so to some extent you're using some phenomenological facts to help you make a guess.
That's it. So, what is our proposed cutoff? So now we're in. So we're done with this introduction. So now, what is our proposed cutoff? What is the time frame? When did this
12 minutes.
Have 12 minutes left? So, here's our proposal very briefly. I can't even blame people for asking tons of questions. Okay. So, by analogy with ADS-CFT, we expect that the right description of eternal inflation, the true non-perturbative description, lives on the boundary. The conformal boundary of the space-time. And really, this comes back to your question. I mean, we're saying that there's something wrong with general relativity, and that if we had a correct non-perturbative description of this system, then this ratio would be well-defined. Okay. And for today, the non-perturbative description I'm going to imagine is some kind of DSCFT, like the one considered by Strominger and Maloney and other people, which in some sense lives on all of future infinity here. Okay, some kind of theory which lives on this boundary. And then the idea that I want to implement, again motivated by ADS-CFT, is that a UV cutoff on the boundary corresponds to a late time or infrared cutoff in the ball. Okay? So, roughly, if I cut off this boundary theory by putting it on some lattice, then that leads to some surface in the ball. And that surface is defined so that the future light cone from a point is one lattice spacing large. Okay? I'm not going to literally put a lattice on the boundary. I'm just going to compute the volume of the future light cone. So to decide whether an event is included, so events are included below the cutoff if their volume, the volume of the future light cone measured on future infinity is bigger than some minimum volume V0. And then later, to take the late time limit, I'm going to take V0 to 0. Now, of course, the physical volume of this surface here is infinite. But what I want to compute is the volume of the future light cone in the conformally rescaled metric. And that's finite. So the natural metric on the boundary, just like in ADS, is a conformally rescaled version of the bulk metric. And that's the metric where these volumes are finite, and that's where I want to define this limit.
Ben?
Yes.
Didn't Lenny tell us that that boundary is horribly nasty?
Yeah,
Did
well...
you tell us that a little bit?
No. Nothing does worse.
Well, so I'll get to some of the issues that arise here. Okay, if you just evolve for some finite time and only keep bubbles that are bigger than some size, then you have a sort of a fractal that you have something which is not yet a fractal that you can deal with. So I guess what I'm saying is that the UV cutoff version of this boundary, at least at a geometrical level, is not a terrible thing. Now I think there are deeper questions as well about whether this makes sense. But let's avoid those for now.
So are the conscious in there or not?
For the moment, there can be crunches in here, but I'm going to treat them in some. I'm going to also smooth them out a little bit. Well, what I want to talk about is the UV cutoff version of the boundary theory. But these are the types of issues that.
But just to be clear, so is the topology that's defined, or at least instead of going after the volume, go after some global topology like what Lenny was doing yesterday?
Topology won't cut it off. I need a metric type of thing like the volume to cut off the infinity. Okay. So, all right. But this proposal, as it stands, is ambiguous because the metric on future infinity. But the metric on future infinity is only defined up to a rescaling. By an arbitrary function. Okay, these are all boundary coordinates A and B and X. So we need some way to fix that ambiguity. And the proposal, which has to be taken just as phenomenology at this point, it's a relatively simple proposal, is that the curvature scalar of the boundary should be constant. That's a condition on, so the metric on future infinity is only determined by the bulk spacetime up to a conformal factor. And then this is going to be our choice of the conformal factor.
Is this just analogous to a preferred slicing?
Yeah.
Okay.
All I'm trying to do is to construct a preferred slicing in a way that's motivated by the boundary. But now, of course, we don't know very much about the boundary theory. So all I'm using about the boundary theory is this UVIR connection.
But what is the motivation for constant?
It's a simple condition. Presumably, the boundary theory has some sort of gauge invariance. Perhaps it's a simple gauge for analyzing the boundary theory. Okay. If I don't, I need to pick some gauge for putting in a UV cutoff, and maybe this is the natural one to do it.
Are you assuming general relativity theory?
Well, at this level, it doesn't really matter, but I am.
Well, in GR, that you're saying mass density is constant, or rather the trace.
This is a condition on the boundary.
Yeah.
The boundary doesn't. The conformal boundary doesn't satisfy Einstein's equations.
Okay, we're not satisfying GR.
It's a conformally rescaled metric.
We're talking about a three-dimensional metric on future infinity, and that doesn't solve. It's a Euclidean.
Would it matter any if you let R be vary on co-moving scales?
No. This is R equals constant. Really, the physical condition is just that R should be finite.
But then you intend to apply this even when you have crunches and, you know, sort of zero cosmological constant bubbles, which you think the boundary would be null, and in one case an infinite curvature in another.
That's right. So those are a problem, and I'll tell you the issues there. Okay. So let me just say, since I'm running out of time, that before we get to these subtle issues that people are asking about, which is a good gauge fixing. This fixes the ambiguity. Okay, and in simple cases, to get a feeling for what this cutoff does, let's analyze a simple case. So first of all, if we start with the sitter space, the metric on the boundary is just a three sphere. So now, if we cut off the boundary at some finite size, the corresponding bulk cutoff looks like something like this. Okay, this is the surface with whose future light cones are a constant size. Now let's suppose we have one bubble in the de Sitter space. Okay. Now the conventional diagram that people like to draw in that case is the one where they map it to the Einstein static universe. And if you have a bubble of a lower cosmological constant inside, the conformal diagram actually looks like this. This gives you a metric on future infinity. There's spherical symmetry, so we can write the metric in a form that looks like this. R squared over rho. And that's not going to have R equals constant, but you can see that this thing is conformally flat. And so the right metric here, this is the wrong metric, the right metric is again a three sphere. And if you want a picture of what the cutoff is going to look like, the cutoff, you can draw kind of an ugly version of the conformal diagram, where you force this line to be straight at the expense that light rays or any other kind of thing that pass through here jump discontinuously over to here. This is a horrible bulk diagram, except that this cutoff surface looks rather simple on it. If you have a cutoff surface that looks like this, inside here, it looks just the same. And then outside here, it does something a little bit complicated. But that's actually never the region of interest. And this actually works for any homogeneous FRW bubble. All you have to do is map that FRW bubble to a triangle like this conformally, and then the cutoff surface will look like that. And the metric will still be around three sphere. So in the approximation of homogeneous FRW universes, then the boundary is a round sphere.
The height of the two horizontal lines is the same? Two horizontal portions.
Exactly.
And the boundary region in between, that's fairly thin.
Yeah, that's right. And then nothing...
So it's pretty local. It's pretty local.
That's right. And this looks discontinuous just because I've chosen this horrible diagram. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this is as a physical surface in the bulk space-time. It's a continuous surface.
So this is constant density surface? Is that what you're...
stop flapping here? Or
no.
No. You said R is constant.
Yeah. Yeah,
this is the boundary R.
This is the 3R.
Yeah.
Okay, that's
yeah, but it's not the curvature of the space in the Einstein sense. It's been rescaled, the geometry has been rescaled by an omega, which is chosen to make the curvature.
Ah, okay.
Now, it does, just to confuse the issue, it does happen to be true that in special cases... Oh, sorry. Let me Okay. So that's the simple diagram. Now, I think I'm going to have to skip this. So now you could write some equations. Right. You can write some equations. So we have 2 minutes to finish up here. Well. All right. So, well, I guess I should just skip straight to the conclusions. So what you can analyze the attractor behavior here more carefully, and you can analyze it rigorously in this limit, and it corresponds to some simple rules for building up the boundary fractal. And you can see that the results are independent of the initial conditions. Okay? And then, you can also, so I didn't get a chance to show that this was similar to other cutoffs, but let me just see. So there are some universal results. In all of the cutoffs, which are currently viable. One of them is that if you consider observers, if you consider vacua, which have the cosmological constant dominating long before the time of observers, say after galaxies have a chance to form, but before observers, those, the number of observers that are counted underneath the cutoff is suppressed in this way. And this resolves a mild tension between the Weinberg argument and the observed cosmological constant. This tells you that there's a penalty for living in a place that has, it's unlikely to live in a place where the cosmological constant dominates.
Could I think he observed the time scale for evolution to produce some good? Is that what
it is? Yeah. Yeah. And another universal feature is that the longest lived vacuum dominates the volume. And another universal feature is that there's no reward for extra E holdings of slow roll inflation. Beyond what's necessary to flatten the universe so that structure formation can occur. But in this case, the fact that there's 100 E-foldings over there is really not relevant in any of the cutoffs that we have. Okay, so there's non-trivial tests. Okay, these measures could be disproved by, for example, finding very long-lived vacua. And also, the big open question is how to go beyond phenomenology. What is the right holographically dual theory? That's the big question. We've made good progress doing phenomenology, and now we need to know how to go beyond that. All right, thank you.
Time for just one quick question.
Can I ask why you don't count the volume? In this simple example, without blah blah mathematics, why you won't count more the extra e-foldings? The logic seems to be is naive, I just count, but then you are not going to count the
points. Well, I think I defined a relatively simple proposal here.
No, no, I understand that with a given proposal you can choose or not to choose, and then, but is there a reason?
It's not really a choice. I mean, say we take the simplest possible thing to think about, I think, is the scale factor cutoff. So you just evolve 1D folding everywhere.
No,
and there, the reason I don't reward these people is that rather than inflating here, okay, I can instead sit in here for longer and inflate inside here and then jump out through here. Okay? So it doesn't really make a difference whether you inflate along here or whether you stay in the false vacuum for longer and you inflate in there. Either way, you're making more volume. Another way to say it is, if you want to produce a bubble of this kind before the cutoff, you have to leave more time, because you have to leave time for 100 E foldings of inflation. So you need to nucleate that bubble earlier. Since the space outside is exponentially expanding, nucleating the bubble earlier carries a penalty. That penalty exactly cancels the extra volume you get from the 100 E foldings of inflation.
Okay, let's thank Ben again. So we have a 10 minutes coffee break, so we start at 5:45. Thank you.